and we're spending the evening with Congressman Bill Flores. If you have questions, questions@WTAW.com, or you can call or text us at 979-695-1620. The this is from Alicia in Waco. The representative's website prominently features a running U.S. debt clock. Defense spending accounts for more than half of the U.S. budget, and President Trump wants to increase this spending without generating any additional revenue to pay for it. If Representative Flores actually cares about mounting U.S. debt, why isn't he opposing this sky-high expenditure?
Let me say this. First of all, it's a great question. One of the things I do worry about as a CPA and is the level of debt that this country's carrying. $20 trillion of borrowed debt plus another $70 trillion for Medicare plus another $17 to $20 for Social Security plus another $10 of a basket of other items brings us up to over $100 trillion of debt and unfunded obligations. And that's a huge load on future generations. But if you go back to the Constitution, what's the number one responsibility of the federal government? It is to protect us. It's to secure our country, our borders, and to secure us internationally. And so the most important expenditure that we have in the federal government is defense. Defense is actually, if you look at a $3.5 trillion budget, two-thirds of that consist of autopilot or entitlement-type programs, Social Security, Medicaid, Medicare, and then a basket of other things, and including interest on the debt. One-third, or about $1.1 trillion, is called discretionary. And about half of that's defense, and about half of that is non-defense. So if you think about the numbers, that means defense spending is only about 18 to 20% of the entire federal budget. But it's the most important responsibility under our Constitution of the federal budget. So that's the last place you want to cut, particularly when you look at the threat set to the United States. You've got China, Russia, North Korea, Iran, the Islamic State. Those are risks that we can't ignore. And we've got a military that has been run pretty hard through the global war on terror. So we need to be increase our spending. So what the president's proposed to do is to cut the non-defense discretionary part of the budget and to increase the defense discretionary part of the budget. And I support that. I don't approve of every cut that he'd come up with. I think we're going to have to reallocate the cuts in the non-defense discretionary part. But I do support the increase in defense spending. Now, at the end of the day, one of the areas where I disagree with the president is he said, don't touch Social Security and don't touch Medicare. The problem is those things are going to blow the budget up. They are already blowing the budget up. And we've got to fix those so that they're here for our kids and grandkids. And you can do it. I mean, we can do it without affecting current retirees or those that are close to retirement. And we can also make sure that these programs are sustainable for the future. If we fix those two programs, it will do more to provide for the fiscal sanity of our future than anything else. The defense budget is not the problem here. We don't have... and some people say we'll raise taxes. We don't have a revenue problem. We've got a spending problem, but it's in that two-thirds of the budget called autopilot spending.
Well, maybe some specificity then, because I've got another question on that.
Sure.
You're protecting Social Security benefits for the elderly and disabled. You say they will be protected, but what about the rest of those folks who are not into that elderly or disabled category?
Well, what we propose to do is if you are about age 57 or older, your benefits would be untouched. So if you're in retirement or close to retirement, it's actually about age 59. But what we're proposing beyond that is to in terms of fixing Social Security, adjust the retirement age to fit longevity. The retirement age was last adjusted back in the 80s under Reagan. So we need to fix that. We need to change the COLA to reflect the true cost of retired.
Cost of living.
The cost of living. I'm sorry,
that's
I'm using
right.
Washington
okay.
speak.
That's all right.
It's a bad thing. The other thing is we can means test Social Security benefits to wealthier retirees so that they get less compared to others. And so by twisting those three knobs on Social Security in terms of the option set we have, you can make Social Security solvent for 75 years, which under federal budget guidelines is eternity. And I support that, and I think that when I talk to millennials today, they say they don't think they're going to have Social Security. And I say, you know, you're right. You're not, because I've seen the numbers. And we're going to have a cut. I mean, all retirees today are going to have a cut in about 10 to 11 years when the benefit expenditures coming out of Social Security, which already exceed the income going into it, when they exhaust the so-called Social Security Trust Fund, benefits will be cut by 22%, just like that. And so if we don't want that to happen, then we need to fix Social Security, and we need to do it sooner rather than later. Every day that we wait to fix Social Security and Medicare, our available options get thinner and thinner and tougher and tougher.
If my high school history teacher was right, he said Social Security in its original form was a great plan. But what happened is politicians kept picking in there, taking money out, to the point, and you know the numbers better than I do, but the amount of disability money that's paid out of Social Security is staggering. Can you share that and address that part of the problem?
Yes, let me say two things. I would disagree with the original notion that Social Security was originally designed well. Any kind of a benefit plan ought to involve, shouldn't have an intergenerational transfer of wealth from one generation to another. And Social Security, the way it was originally designed, was to take from the working generation and give it to the retired generation. That's fine if you've got a great, if you're always expanding your population of working people and your retired population is not growing or it's shrinking. That's not what we have. We've got a rapidly aging population. We don't have a growing working population. So the number of workers per retiree is way down below what it was when this was designed. So it's what we call actuarially unsound, and it's always been that way. So what we need to do is make it actuarially sound or closer to that if we can. But you're right. The disability fund is being abused. President Obama expanded the definition of disability and basically used it during the first 5 years of his presidency to make it extended unemployment insurance. And so, you remember what Congress did early in like 2009-10 is they extended the length of time people could stay on unemployment insurance. Well, people start to run out of that, and so they just loosen the definition. And so we wind up with all these what I would call able-bodied people that are milking the system. I mean, I've seen them in this community when I ride around with the police department. People that are unemployed that look perfectly fine to me, and they're not working. They're on Social Security disability, and that's terrible for the system. We need to go back to what's truly disabled. We need for those folks to have their disability review rechecked every 6 months or so. If you're truly disabled, you get a benefit. If you're not, you need to go to work.
This is from an email from College Station. Undocumented workers pay about $12 billion each year in state and local taxes. You'll be able to tell me if that's right or not. I will assume based on what they've said. But with the new immigration laws being enforced, many will not submit tax forms this year. Without Social Security and having to include their home addresses on returns, they fear deportation. The question, how will states keep up from losing big time here?
Well, I don't know. I don't have the exact number for you. Not that many. In terms of undocumented or illegal aliens in this country, not many of them actually own property. So they're not paying property taxes. They may be paying rent on a place that's going to property taxes, but they're not paying property taxes. They're not filing their tax returns. They may be having tax withheld, but they're not filing tax returns for the most part. So that's been a net benefit to the federal government because they're not filing to get anything back. At the end of the day, there are other costs, though, because if we're educating their children, our broad group of taxpayers is paying that. That said, I mean, where I am in terms of the illegal population here today and is that I believe we ought to have a path to legal status. And the way it would work is if you're here illegally under this program, you register with the government, you submit to a background check, a criminal background check. If you're not a criminal, then you can you pay a fine, you maybe pay it over time, pay your back taxes, and then we give you a temporary visa. And you can have a job, you can own property, you can drive a car, have a driver's license, just everything that the rest of us do except not vote. And then after 5 to 10 years of probation in that status, then we give you permanent legal residency so you'd have a permanent green card. I'm fine with that. This district is typically fine with that. For Dreamers, what I would propose to do is to give them a path to earn citizenship. So because they didn't really commit the crime that their parents did, but there's still sort of that taint on there. So I'd say you clear that up by community service or some sort of public service or military service, and you're on a path to citizenship. I mean, look, if your parents brought you here from Venezuela when you're two, and we deport you back to Venezuela, you're an American essentially in Venezuela, and you don't know anything that's going on down there. So, we're educating these kids. Let's keep them here. You know, the good thing about the president, he said that he wants to do something for these kids, and he also at the same time said he's willing to talk about a path to legal status for the folks that are here legally, the non-criminal folks that are here legally.
Well, to that point, because we got a question, because you did say this on Tuesday night, much the same,
right,
how you feel that the Dreamers should be treated differently because they had no control over their circumstance.
Correct.
But there are yet reports that Dreamers are being arrested and being treated as undocumented when they are college students with no crimes. Your thoughts there?
I haven't heard that directly. We had one of those questions come up in okay. earlier town hall, so we've asked HHS to get the numbers. Let me say this. When President Obama had a roundup and deportation program going through the last 4 or 5 years of his administration, but it wasn't cool for the media to carry it, so they never talked about it. And so President Trump is doing the same thing, albeit on an expanded basis, but now it's cool to talk about it. You know, it's just because of media bias against this president versus the last president. And so, but here are the numbers that I do know, and that is for every group of 100 people that were rounded up under the Obama administration, about 60 of them were actual criminal types, and about 40 of them wound up getting caught up in the roundup and deported. Today, that number is higher than 70%. So if anything, the President Trump's roundups have wound up being exercising better definition, better granularity in terms of rounding up criminals vis-a-vis non-criminals. And so I think what you get into those numbers, in terms of Dreamers being rounded up, I don't think they should be, but I'll check into that and find out. I don't have exact numbers on that.
If you'd like to give us a call, you can do that, 979-695-1620. Let's go to a call. This is Debbie and Brian. Debbie, go ahead.
Bill, what can you tell us about future care for veterans in the VA system? Is there going to be a way for them to seek outside medical care? If so, how will that work?
Okay. Debbie, I appreciate you bringing that up. We just yesterday, the president signed an extension of the Veterans Choice Act. And just as a reminder as to what the Veterans Choice Act is, if you roll the clock back to 2014, remember we had the scandal over the waiting list and veterans that were dying while they were waiting for care. After our hearings and investigations of the VA, we passed something called the Veterans Choice Act. And in the Veterans Choice Act, we allowed a veteran that lived more than 40 miles away from a VA facility or one that had to wait more than 30 days for care to be able to use a local health care provider. And that program was set to run out in the next few months. We've extended that. We've actually added some enhancements to it. It passed both the House and the Senate, and the president signed it. This is the, in my view of the world, is the future of the Veterans Administration. This morning I was at the ribbon-cutting ceremony for a center of excellence in Waco for PTSD and traumatic brain injury and to deal with the neurological effects of modern-day warfare. And what we ought to do is set up centers of excellence where the VA is unmatched in the private sector, TBI, PTSD, polytrauma-type situations, burns and crush injuries. Those types of injuries don't get as good a treatment in the private sector, but the VA gives unsurpassed care in those areas, the VA and the military working together. So if I could design the whole VA system over again from scratch, I would set up these centers of excellence around the country, and we would transport the veteran and their family to those areas until they were healed. And then everybody else would get essentially an insurance card to go to their health care provider of their choice in their community. What happens when we do that? Our veteran winds up getting quicker health care, more effective health care from a doctor they know and trust and like and can use on a long-term basis. And the taxpayer winds up actually feeling better about the investment that they're making in veterans' health care. That's where I see the 21st century VA moving, or 21st century veterans' health care. And that's what I hope to do. Will it happen during my lifetime or my time in Congress? I don't think so, but we're going to try hard to get there. But we have sowed the seeds, and we just need to water them heavily now.
Vicky emailed in while you were answering that. So Are there any other high points in that bill that the president signed concerning veteran health care, and when does that go into effect?
Well, it goes in. It's already in effect. The Veterans Choice Act is already in effect, so it's an extension. I don't remember the actual enhancements off the top of my head, but we've got Jordan sitting in here, and Jordan's going to go find them out real quick, and he'll give me a note in a minute that has them. And
all right,
we'll go through that.
Here's the text. I am a retired federal employee, and I have a thrift savings plan, tax deferred, with the current rate for withdrawal is 20%. My question is: the rate for withdrawal going to be lowered in that new tax reform legislation?
I haven't seen anything with respect to withdrawals from retirement plans and tax reform. So my gut answer is no. But I'll find out for sure. I haven't seen anything that affects retirement plans at all in tax reform. So I think we're safe in saying no, but I will double check that.
Well, give us an idea, because they are still working. And again, if Secretary of the Treasury is right, we may be really close to having some sort of a bill for tax reform. So here you are in Bryan College Station. How do you keep up with that? How do you hear how things are trending when you're away from D.C.?
You want to know my real secret?
Okay.
Okay. Well, our congressman neighbor to the east is Kevin Brady.
Yep.
And for some strange reason, he and I are always on the same flights to and from Washington, and we're always sitting next to each other.
Okay.
I mean, it's just weird. He must have a seat preference. It's right next to my seat preference. And so I always grill him about what's happening on tax reform, so I get a pretty good download. And he hasn't said anything about retirement accounts. So I think whether it's federal retirement or your own IRA or a 401k, I think everybody's safe on that.
All right. George wants us to go back to one more question having to do with Social Security. Why not raise the cap on Social Security or eliminate the cap altogether?
Actually, I think this used to be correct. You could go to SSA.gov, and there's a dashboard in there where you can do things and see. You can twist knobs and see what the impact is on the solvency of Social Security. And there is a knob in there about taking the cap off on Social Security earnings. The reason I don't like that is if you're going to means test higher income retirees, you're slapping them once, and then if you raise the tax on them, you're slapping them twice. And so it seems to me like you should only slap them once. And when you look at when you twist those knobs, you'll see that the impact from the means testing gives you a better solvency extension than taking the cap off the earnings. And so we've decided, okay, we're just going to slap upper income taxpayers once. It's going to be pretty hard, but they're going to be slapped once. And then we're not, and that gives us, and get the most bang for the buck at it. If you uncap it too, then it becomes pretty intense. And it doesn't extend the longevity of Social Security that much longer.
Email us at questions@WTAW.com, or you can give us a call, 979-695-1620. You can text to that number as well. Let's turn our attention to tax. Rebecca and Brian says, small businesses really need tax reform. S-Corps are paying almost twice what big business pays. How do we bring tax reform back to the front burner?
Well, I want to go back to Social Security for just a minute.
Okay.
I will say this. Somebody brought up an idea of raising the cap on Social Security up to whatever Congress makes, and so right now we're getting paid $174,000. I kind of agree with that. I think Congress ought to have the full impact, feel the full hit.
Okay.
And so right now,
get that passed for us.
Yeah.
Okay.
The urban legend is that members of Congress don't pay Social Security. We do, and I do. And by the way, the urban legend is I got this fancy health care plan. I'm not. I'm on Obamacare. So I feel that you ought to hear my Democratic neighbors scream about it. They won't do it publicly, of course, but they do. But back. Boy, I tell you what, the question hits the nail on the head. Our small businesses are getting crushed. That used to be the engine of economic growth in this country that produces 50% of the job growth in this country or more. And they are just getting murdered with the regulatory scheme that came out of the last administration, the least competitive tax system in the world. And so what we propose under tax reform is to keep the pass-through structure. So if you're a sub-S or an LLC or LLP or whatever kind of a pass-through entity you have, or even a subchapter S corporation, what we propose to do is to leave that structure in place and then to say that you will pay tax on your personal tax return at the business tax rate, the same rate as corporations, and we're proposing that that rate's going to be 20 to 25%. And so if you if you are only a small business here, the income from your business would flow on, and you have a separate line that says business income, and that would be taxed at whatever the C corporation tax rate would be. Now, it'd be really cool. I mean, it would light the economy on fire.
Well, and that's a good way. I think there was some talk about that we need to come up with just a corporate tax that brings it down to whatever that magic number happens
Correct.
To be, no matter what the size. And that, well, I think the market did pretty well today. They were anticipating some good news.
Right.
Sticking with this, David from College Station, small businesses need a path to get loans in order to grow right. and create more jobs. So what can we do about that?
The biggest thing, how do I say this? One of the worst bills that Congress passed back in the 2009-2010 timeframe was Dodd-Frank. Dodd-Frank punished the banking community that had nothing to do with the housing meltdown. The biggest guilty parties were Fannie Mae and Freddie Mae. They were not touched by Dodd-Frank. It was obscene how they were allowed to escape.
A lot of people thought folks should go to jail for
that. Yeah, particularly in those two organizations,
right.
because they were paying off people like Barney Frank, you know, whose name is on Dodd-Frank.
Right.
And so our banking community got slammed with all these extra regulations, including our community banks. And so if you've got a bank here in town, they're the ones that are funding the Little League. They're the ones that are funding the Rotary Club's charity function, you know, for wounded warriors. And they're just getting their eyes drilled out. They had nothing to do with the financial meltdown. So what we're proposing to do, and I'm hopeful this bill will hit the floor in the next few weeks, is to come up with a definition of community bank and basically exempt them from all of Dodd-Frank, which has just crushed them. And so when you take the sand out of the gears of our community banking system, then suddenly all those banks that have had difficulty lending the last few years are free to lend to our small businesses, so our small businesses have the capital to grow and prosper. It's just a huge help for our local economy. I met with about 12 community bankers from this community just last week, and then back in January I met with a bunch of them from Waco. And they're all telling me the same thing about how how Dodd-Frank and the CFPB are just crushing them. And so we propose to pick a number, let's say like $50 billion in assets and below, and exempt them from Dodd-Frank. And they'll still be subject to all the old regulatory structures, but our banks were sound back then. I mean, the community banks never got into the jam of the big ones like, Bank of America. I can't remember the one that almost failed, but anyway, so let the big guys pay the charges on that. I mean, let them suffer that, not those community banks.
Yeah, you have a talk with a small banker, and they tell you the hoops they have to go through are high and expensive.
Terrible. And you know who it hurt the worst? Our low-income folks in this community. They can't open a demand deposit account anymore, a typical free checking account.
Right.
Those aren't available. They can't get a mortgage loan. They can't get a mobile home loan, and they can't get a car loan because of the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau.
Well, let's
so they're protected from being able to borrow any money.
Because we got an email about that. Poverty is one of your concerns as well as one of the top five or six issues for your party. So what are some of the solutions that you would suggest, since the Brazos Valley does have, I mean, we do have some folks who fall within those categories. What are your thoughts?
We do, and actually it's not limited just to Brazos County.
Sure.
I mean, we've got some other counties that have a higher than acceptable. Well, I don't think any poverty is acceptable.
Right.
But,
well, just between here and Waco, we're talking about some counties that are in serious problems.
Exactly. Yeah. So what we look at is what were we trying to do with the war on poverty? We were trying to get people out of poverty. Has it worked? No. How much did it cost? $19 trillion. What did we measure? We just measured how much we put into it. We measured how many people were on these programs. We never demanded any accountability or any results. We never looked at any measurements on how effective were we spending this money. So what we're proposing to do is step back and say, what's the best single thing we can do? And that's to help a family get a good job with a good paycheck. Because with that paycheck, they can house that family, they can feed that family, they can educate the family, they become part of a growing, vibrant local community, and they become part of a healthy middle class. And so there are some things we have to do. So let's say that we've got a family here in town, and they are really good at getting all the benefits that are available in the federal poverty program. So they can make I'm using quotes quotations around make about $35,000 tax free. So if the one of the adults in that family goes down here to across the street to Walmart and gets a job at $12 an hour, that's $24,000 a year roughly. They lose more economic benefit in their welfare benefits than they pick up in that $24,000 paycheck. And so, I mean, people are smart. They make economic decisions. Say, hey, it's better for me to stay on all this free stuff rather than go to work. So we've got to change that out, change that system so people are always incentivized to go to work. You're always better to get that job.
I'm listening.
And so
give me some ideas. Okay, How do we incentivize?
Well, some of the ideas are to change it where you don't have these welfare cliffs so that so you begin to say, okay, you basically reduce the amount of welfare benefits at a certain income range. And so as you begin to pick up a paycheck, the decrease in the welfare benefits is a lot softer than it is today because now it's more of a cliff. And so by changing that structure of the payments out, the benefits out, people always want to get a better job, maybe work more hours or whatever. The other thing, too, is we've got like 80-plus programs, and nobody's measuring the outcome. So what we think about is, what does a family in poverty need most? Okay, you need education or job training. You need some housing. Probably need some nutrition support, some financial support, maybe some transportation. So if you think about what sort of a and not every family needs all those benefits. So what we'd say is something like this. What if we give you a basket of so much money and you can choose from this a la carte menu of these benefits, subject to a limit? So if you need job training, we'll give you so many dollars for that. If you need housing, so many dollars for that. If you need nutrition, so many dollars for that, subject to drug testing on all these and subject to trying to get work. If you're a fully disabled person or if there's something that keeps you from working, it doesn't apply to those folks. But if you're an able-bodied person and should be able to get off poverty, we're going to give you a way to get there. You'll have you'll be able to sustain your life, but we want you to get off of poverty and go to work. And so that's what we're talking about doing.
But how many government employees are involved in this very endeavor right now? There are people who, if you pare this down, which you should be able to if the numbers go down, they'd lose their jobs. So you'll get pushback within the system itself.
I don't care how many of those folks lose their job because what I want them to do is get off the taxpayer back and go get the private sector and produce something, make something. So, and I think that's where most of our taxpayers are in this. Is that, look, one of the biggest problems we in Congress have is if you look at welfare, it's spread across at least three big cabinet-level agencies, Department of Agriculture, Housing and Urban Development, and actually you've got some over in Health and Human Services, and you've got some over in another agency I can't remember off the top of my head. And so you've got them spread out. And if you try to get a full comprehensive cost or try to find one point of contact, you can't. So you may have programs over here with SNAP in the Department of Agriculture or food stamps that conflict with the way that the housing is being adjudicated over here in Housing and Urban Development. To me, we ought to have one department that is responsible for helping to get people out of poverty, and it ought to have one cabinet-level person, and all the dollars go in there, and Congress can see all the dollars that are going there, and we know exactly how to measure it, and we demand results, and we demand accountability. Because right now, the way the system is designed to obfuscate the results and how much it cost. And that's, we're proposing just basically rip all this out by the roots and start over, but always and try to incentivize people to work, but to equip them to work. I mean, child care could be one of the things you provide so that people could work.
We've got about 30 minutes left. We're going to take another 3-minute break, and then we'll be back.